Hi, and welcome back to the Ice World podcast. I'm your host, Nadia. If you've been following this podcast, you'll notice that a female voice has replaced the wonderful Scottish voice of Rob Taylor. I crossed over with Rob in the Southern Hemisphere summer in 2021, just before he was due to sail back on the James Clark Ross as he terminated his position as a field guide at Rothera Research Station on the West Antarctic Peninsula. A year later, and the episodes are out. We heard in episode 1 how people made it to Antarctica during a pandemic. After leaving the port of Harwich in the UK, the James Clark Ross's first destination was South Georgia, a formidable archipelago where wildlife abounds. At 54 degrees south, South Georgia's location in the Atlantic Ocean is classed as subantarctic. Interestingly, the position of South Georgia in the Southern Hemisphere is equivalent to that of Yorkshire in the Northern Hemisphere at 54 degrees of latitude. However, without the protection of the Gulf Stream, the winter is bitterly cold, with the daily average temperatures hovering around just 0 degrees and can reach minus 12 degrees in the coldest months of June and July. The water temperatures drop below freezing, which are temperatures similar to that experienced in Antarctica.
So Vicky Foster, you'll be the station leader at Bird Island. How do you feel about this voyage?
I'm very excited. We're going to go through the tropics, we're going to see boobies and dolphins and whales. It's going to be awesome.
And have you done this kind of journey before? Is this the first time you'll be on a ship for such a long period of time?
No, I travelled from March through to June, all the way back from Bird Island to the UK.
And now you're undertaking a voyage of a similar magnitude in the same year. That's quite strange, actually.
It is, but it's a very strange year.
You'll be the station leader on Bird Island, so that means that you'll be 4 weeks on the JCR.
That is correct. 4 weeks down and then 7 weeks sailing back up again.
How big will your team be on Bird Island?
There are 9 of us staying over summer, and then when they take us out at the end of the summer, there'll just be 4 people left over winter.
Wow, you're going to have quite a busy summer season.
It's going to be very busy. I'm usually down there for 4 months, so only having 8 weeks is quite short.
Bird Island hosts a tiny research station which is run by British Antarctic Survey scientists and support staff. It is located on the northwest tip of South Georgia and is isolated from the main island by a narrow strait appropriately named Bird Sound. As Vicky explained, with only 4 staff remaining on the station for 8 months of the Southern Hemisphere winter, I find it hard to imagine when the island is only 4.8 kilometres in diameter. And I thought the prospect of wintering with only 23 people at Rothera was bad enough.
James Crimble is the ornithologist on board, and he'll be the zoological field assistant at Bird Island. James has been up on deck every single day out of the 3 days that we've been sailing. What birds have you seen so far?
The highlight of the trip so far for me has been a great shearwater. That was actually a lifer. And we've had a few wacky birds on board as well. We've had a pair of starlings tailing us since we left the UK. Also, there's been a redwing, robin, and a woodcock, surprisingly, which has been, yeah, probably the wackiest of them all. It's been absolutely fantastic. It's been much better than I thought it was going to be, at least for the first leg of the journey. I was fully expecting as soon as we get past the equator that everything would kick off, but it's been really good so far.
Why are we getting terrestrial boards when we're so far out at sea? Because we're 200 nautical miles off the continental shelf.
Yeah, well, we're actually at the tail end of migration right now. So these are probably the dregs, the late birds. They've probably been caught up in a bad weather system and they've been just pushed onto the boat. Now, as we are passing through the channel, it's probably quite common for birds to land on a ship, but the woodcock was only spotted today. So, yeah, that one was probably just caught up in a bad storm in France and managed to find the boat. They see the boat as a big physical object in the middle of the sea. You think, oh, great, I can get a bit of a rest there. And they'll hang around the boat for a while. Probably when we get closer down to Tenerife or something like that, they'll sniff out land again and fly off and leave us. And otherwise, they'll come all the way down to the Antarctic with us.
So, Nadia, we're up on the bridge. Tell us, are you having a whaley good time?
I'm having a whaley good time, Ryan. I have just seen my first whale, and it has been absolutely amazing. We've been on the deck since 6:30 this morning watching the sunrise, and we've had intermittent stops for breakfast and lunch, but generally we're just keeping binoculars glued to our face and looking out for any marine mammals we can see. So about 2:30, when there was some circuit training, we saw 3 blows, but they were quite far away in the distance and we weren't able to see any whales. But in the last 20 minutes we have seen a whale come within 50 metres of the boat, and it has been absolutely amazing. I'm just buzzing. But now we're just looking out to sea, and there's three gannets flying in a beautiful formation over the water, and there's one above it. Gannets are big seabirds, and they've got black tips on the ends of their wings. They look a little bit like an aeroplane, and when they dive into the water, they just bomb. So yeah, on deck we've got six observers. There's four people with super good cameras that have got 600mm zoom, and we took some photos of the whale and looked at the dorsal fin and tried to identify what it is. So Ryan's actually been doing the identification. Ryan, what species do you think that we have potentially caught on camera?
So it is possible that we had a large minke whale off our starboard side, which is the whale that we just saw. It wasn't a very good sighting. It's very cloudy, it's quite dark at the moment, so we weren't able to make out any patterns. So if it's not a minke whale, it could be a juvenile fin whale or juvenile sei whale. We're not too sure entirely what it was, but it was pretty fantastic that it was alongside.
This has been a great day and the first day of whale sighting.
Oh yeah, that's been my best whale sighting ever. That was really good. Usually I see whales when I'm sat on land looking through a telescope. It's freezing cold and I can't move my fingers, and all I see is a tiny little dorsal fin and it's a big black shape in the water. So actually to get a bird's eye view of a whale as we overtake it on the ship was, that's something. That's really good.
How have you been finding the wind, James? Because today is definitely howling and conditions have picked up. What was it like for you staying outside all day?
It's not too bad, actually. Now we're actually a bit further south, but it's a lot better than it was yesterday when we were still around the UK. Yeah, it is a bit windy. It's a bit too windy to use your binoculars right up against the banister of the monkey deck. You've got to take a step back and you're not getting battered by the wind out there.
Thanks, James. And we look forward to different bird species, especially as we get closer to the equator.
We're coming to the southern end of the Bay of Biscay now. So how many more sightings do you think we'll get?
I think we're going to have at least another five by the time that we hit northern Spain on Sunday.
Marek, it's Sunday evening at the bar at the JCL. What's it like?
It's definitely better than on shore. People finally can socialize, can play guitar together, as we can see here. Our fine gentlemen giving all their best guitar skills.
What have you done this Sunday, Marek? Has it felt like a weekend day for you?
Yes, it definitely felt like a weekend. Haven't done any work today, but I've taken some nice pictures, some nice videos, started a new book, and it feels like a good Sunday for me. And it's a bit rocky, but still managed.
Does it help you sleep at night, playing in the boat?
Very well. I expected worse.
But... Marek, I didn't say, what's your job at Rotherham?
I'm IT engineer, and I'll be wintering at Rotherham this season.
And you're already working on the boat, and you've got your own office.
Oh, yes, I have a lovely little space with all the servers humming around me.
On the Monday morning, I took the ship's doctor, Rachel, up on her offer and went to visit her in the surgery to find out what would happen in the event of an emergency when the general alarm would sound.
So in a general alarm, what will happen is the two stewards and second cook come here. The cook grabs the green bag. One of the stewards grabs the oxygen and the defib. I take the bag of drugs and the other steward goes up to a Bravo locker, which is out by the lifeboats. That's where we keep four different types of stretchers. So we would then muster up there, awaiting whoever to tell us where the emergency is. So we're all prepared and we go there together. So in the grab bag, this is the oxygen bag. So everything you need in here. There's a bag valve mask. There's non-rebreathe masks. And if you put your microphone there, that will go up to 15 litres. So in the drug bag, we've got all the drugs that you would need in an emergency. So we've got some atropine, some adrenaline, we've got some steroids, we've got some fluids, we've got some albuterol, aspasis, some stuff to stop seizures, anti-sickness, that sort of stuff. So that's real emergency drug bag.
Yes.
This is the defib. This is a very good defib. It's a plug-and-play situation, so it tells you exactly what to do. So if you've never used a defib before, this would be fine to use. Stick the pads on, it will talk you through what to do. So there's enough for two people in here at once, patient-wise. There's enough for an x-ray machine. I would say it's not a bad size. But what you need to bear in mind is everything has to be tied down. So the layout is different because we're on a ship. So, for example, we've got the x-ray arm here attached to the wall with three different bungee cords, which you wouldn't normally have. Or the drip stands in the corner of the room rather than where you would have it normally because it has to be tied down.
So I am just about to take you on an adventure into the galley. This is the area where
all of our meals are produced, breakfast, lunch and dinner, and cakes in between. There's three chefs and Katie, the Rotherer chef, currently working in there. So very busy operation. So let's go and have a tour.
Chris, you're the head chef.
Yeah,
cool. So we've just come into the galley and this is the kitchen of the ship. So it's quite a spacious environment. You've got different workstations. So can you explain to me a bit the layout, Chris?
Yeah, so we've got what's called the duty mess, which we're looking at right now, which is where the engineers and certain people eat at meal times if they're in the boiler suits because they don't want to saloons. To the right, we've got the ratings mess, which is where all the ratings and CPOs and POs eat. That's petty officers and chief petty officers. And so we have a baker's corner just around the corner, where all the bakery products, breads are done in the morning. And then we have a salad counter, where all these salads are done for upstairs and in all the other messes. We have two combi ovens in the middle of the galley, and then we have a workstation with a frying. And then behind that, we've got a range area where we do a lot of our range work. We also have what's called a brat pan, which is a big industrial frying pan. And then we have a cleaning area, which is where all the sinks are for washing all our dishes.
So essentially, you're doing everything. You're like a jack of all trades in the kitchen. Or does everyone have their own specific roles?
There is specific roles. I'm obviously the head chef on board, so I do the menus, all the paperwork, chuck out of meats and stuff for the coming weeks. And then also we've got Norman, who does the galley steward, as does the salads, keeps on top of the cleaning in the mess rooms and obviously in the galley as well. Then we've got the second cook baker / chief cook, Nick. He does all the bakery products and also helps me with the general running and cleaning of the galley.
Right, and I'm quite impressed already, 12 days in, and we haven't had the same meal yet, so there's quite a variety in the food. So as the head chef, is it you that plans and organises all the meals?
Yeah, we work together, so we try and structure it so there's a balance, and also just ensuring that what we've got down below is used first. So as far as our fresh vegetable room, that's the main thing we're here, because it doesn't last forever, as you well know. Try and get most of the stuff that we can on the menu, basically from looking into the vegetable rooms. The meats which are frozen and the fish which is frozen, we can pick and choose what sort we want to put on. And then we try and experience of being at sea and working on sort of these types of journeys for 20 years. You sort of get to know what people like, pretty traditional, and then you try and throw some little things in there just to excite the palate.
Thanks, Chris. And we do all love those amuse-bouches. I definitely put on a couple of kilos during our voyage. We certainly ate well. Now, on to Katie.
Katie Rum, the Rotherer chef. You find yourself in the galley every day after lunch. What are you making today?
Today I am making, it's actually couscous. It's going to be bulgur wheat, but we couldn't find it. So it's couscous.
Smells amazing.
With aubergine, I've roasted some tomatoes with harissa, homemade harissa. Bit of parsley, coriander, cinnamon fried onions, feta cheese and mint. It's really working because there's a lot of free time, so to come down here and cook for 3 or 4 hours is perfect.
Have you cooked on a ship before, Katie?
I have actually, yeah. I've cooked on a tall ship in a tiny kitchen. It's amazing what you can actually produce when you have to, even when it's rough.
Shortly after I spoke to Chris and Katie in the galley, the James Clark Ross crossed the equator, and we all partook in the crossing the line ceremony, where we were summoned to King Neptune's court to be punished for our sins. This is traditional when crossing the equator, and as first timers, the majority of British Antarctic Survey staff were subject to punishment in the form of food slops that had been stewing in the hot equatorial sun. I then went below deck to find out about the continuous oceanographic measurements that were being collected during our voyage.
Jazz. Ooh. Electronics engineer at Rotherer. You've got work from Bass whilst being on the JCR. What have you been doing for the last few days?
So we have some water sample coming from a clean pump, which is in the bilge, and it's coming through this pipe here. And as you can see, there's instruments to the left and to the right. And so this is where we take all of our samples to measure stuff like salinity, the chlorophyll in the water, the temperature. And this on the left, you get the water coming from the main feed here. And this is an air vent, so any air bubbles get thrown out. It then goes to this instrument, which is measuring salinity. Then the water then passes through here, which is measuring the conductivity of the water, and then cycles around to this instrument, which is currently broken.
So will you be getting a new part for this pump?
I hope so, because you can see this LCD, we're reading zero for everything. And then that data then goes into this box, which then goes to a PC that's under your legs, then goes to upstairs to the lab, But so far, I've been calibrating it manually by hand with this measuring cylinder and looking at timing how long it takes to fill 0.6 of a litre.
Where does this data get sent to?
This is pinged back to Cambridge every 10 minutes. So we're connected to a LAN. So the computer itself is connected to a LAN. It's put into something called a CSV, a common separated variable file, and shot back up to Cambridge.
This was my first exposure to things going wrong in environments where it's not always easy to just get a spare part, but also an insight into how to find solutions to combat the problem. Right, let's get back to the top deck.
Ryan, today's been a great day for Wales.
It's been a really good day. We've just come through the tropics. We're now in the southern hemisphere, well into the southern hemisphere, and we've had our first humpback whale of the entire trip. So this morning, I think before breakfast at around 7 o'clock, we saw one pod made up of two adult humpbacks. And then this afternoon, there's been a second pod, which was a mother calf pod.
And what kind of behaviour have these humpback whales been exhibiting? And how can we actually identify that they are humpbacks?
So we know they're humpback whales because of the shape of the dorsal fin. Humpbacks have this really distinctive hump in front of the dorsal fin, unlike any other whale. So that's really good clue. Also, the rostrum, the head of the whale, has what's called tubercles, and these are hair follicles. They can be the size of golf balls, so if we see those, that's also a really good identifying feature.
And what other whales have we seen today during our survey?
This is really exciting. We saw a pod of beaked whales. There were three individuals. We think they are grazed beaked whales. It's really exciting because whales are very shy creatures. They may be numerous in numbers, but nobody really knows their true population sizes. And they came right alongside the boat, so they probably came to check us out as much as we were checking them out. Really exciting.
Within that group as well, there was potentially some juveniles or sub-adults, as the book classifies them, which have got a slightly darker rostrum, the nose part of the whales. That's pretty interesting to record that group structure within our surveys, so we can see where calves and mothers are distributed throughout these waters. James, thanks for coming back on the show.
Right,
it's been
right.
A really good day. So the sun is just setting. It's Friday night, and you've had a great sighting of albatross over the last 2 days. Can you tell us what you've seen?
So yesterday, quite a nice surprise. It was my first ever albatross species, and it was a Atlantic yellow-nosed albatross, which was absolutely fantastic. I've always wanted to see one because they're one of the most gorgeous birds in the world. So yeah, very happy to see that. But then today, it was an even better surprise. There was about three or four wandering albatross following us for about 4 hours, slowly wheeling around the boat in heavy seas, and that's the sort of really classical albatross experience.
And they're actually still here, they're following the boat, and somebody asked you a question about how they fly. So they fly quite low to the waves to get the wind from the waves to propel themselves, and they don't actually flap their wings that much, so that means they can fly for thousands of kilometres.
Albatross can fly tens of thousands of kilometres. They're really well suited to just making the most out of ocean conditions. So in conditions like this, where it's nice and windy with lots of waves, yeah, as you said, albatross need to expend very little energy to go a very long way. For them, this is perfect conditions. It's actually when it's a lot calmer that they become becalmed, in fact. They can't even take off, and they just kind of sit around, not doing very much.
Bird Island is home to thousands of pairs of breeding birds and common sightings of fur seals, elephant seals, and leopard seals. Bird Island maintains long-term time series about the status of the wildlife. Their work directly informs the conservation and policy in South Georgia's waters. The scientists work hard, undertaking daily surveys in all weather. Perhaps the most spectacular sighting I saw was a wandering albatross up close in a nest. Wandering albatross have the largest wingspan and a magnificent ocean gliders. I would watch in awe as they would sweep past the James Clark Ross with such ease. Now, back to the ship.
You'll be working with albatross when you get to Bird Island, and we're actually approaching Bird Island in the next 4 days. So what species will you be working with on the island?
Well, there's four albatross species that breed on Bird Island. Now, of course, there's the wandering albatross, but there's also grey-headed albatross, which are very similar to the Atlantic yellow-nosed. There's the black-browed albatross, which are quite a cosmopolitan species of albatross. They breed in quite a few places. And there's also light-mantled sooty albatross, and there's quite a small number of them breeding on Bird Island.
What is the name of the pellet that the albatross throw up?
Albatross can regurgitate their food. In fact, that's how they feed their chick. So an albatross regurgitate has a wealth of information inside it, and you can tell by picking it apart what they've been eating and what's going on in the marine environment. So they're a bit like an organic drone going out and doing all the hard science work for us.
What characteristics do you look out for in albatross when you're identifying different species?
Well, one of the first ones is size. Wandering albatross are huge. Their wingspan is about 3.5 meters on the big males, but even the females, they're big in comparison to other albatross species. But really, you're looking at bill colour, the colours of the wings, if they've got colour on their bill, and also where you are in the world. There's a lot of albatross species in the Pacific, and there's a lot of albatross species in the Atlantic, and you can really rule out quite a few based on where you are and which latitude you're at.
Great, and do we get mostly albatross in the southern hemisphere, or are there many species in the northern hemisphere? I know we've got a couple in the northern hemisphere, but are most concentrated in the southern regions. Sorry, yeah. We're just rolling around in the swell right now.
It's quite intense roll. So yeah, they're predominantly a southern hemisphere species, especially in the Atlantic. Yeah, you're really only going to find them at the most southerly latitudes. Although you might get a few vagrants coming up into the northern hemisphere. The UK has had quite a few famous black-browed albatross coming up, and I think one of them actually chilled out with some swans in Germany for a bit. It was quite a confused individual, that one. But in the Pacific, there are a few species that breed in the northern hemisphere. But again, the bias is down towards the south.
As we're moving south, we're at 37 degrees latitude. What whales do we expect to encounter as we move towards South Georgia?
So we should start to see more whales as we head south. Most whales, or most marine mammals, have these long migrations. So during the summers in either hemisphere, the whales will migrate north or south to the feeding areas. In the cold waters, in the polar regions, the waters are much denser. They have a lot more food. So the whales will be, in the summers, be in these cold water environments. The further south we head, we should start to see more whales. So we've had our first humpback whales. We expect to see lots more humpback whales. We also expect to see more fin whales, more sei whales, and hopefully we'll see some blue whales.
Blue whales have had a pretty good success story, especially around South Georgia in the last few years. Surveys conducted by Bass and other organisations in collaboration have found the return of the blue whales, and within a single survey year they recorded 55 individuals. So hopefully as we approach South Georgia we'll see some blue whales.
Yeah, that's really significant, because blue whales were hunted, as with other whales as well, but the blue whales were hunted to near local extinction. Pretty much they did think they were entirely extinct from South Georgia back in the 30s. So to have these numbers sighted now is really significant. It does mean that the blue whales are returning to South Georgia.
And especially because they haven't been seen for so long. Actually, some researchers were worried that the calves or the blue whales wouldn't be able to find these areas again. What marine mammal are you most excited about seeing as we head further south?
For me, definitely a blue whale. I've never seen a blue whale before. They're such impressive animals. They're the largest animals to have ever lived on this planet.
I have to break it to you that despite all the hype, we were not lucky enough to have a sighting of a blue whale. And now it's time to say goodbye to our friends that will be getting off at South Georgia and fulfill their positions as zoological field assistants at Bird Island.
So you'll be at Bird Island in 4 days, and are you excited to leave the JCR?
It's a bit bittersweet, to be honest. I was just dead excited to get down to Bird Island, but being on the JCR for the last 4 weeks has been amazing. Met some really interesting people. So it'll be sad when I have to step off the boat, but also just dead excited to start doing work and really get into what Bird Island has to offer.
Thanks for tuning in to the second episode about the James Clark Ross's voyage. In the next episode, we'll be arriving at Rothera Research Station, located on the West Antarctic Peninsula.